I've been asked to speak about whether Judaism believes in original sin and in the fall of man, or the fall of Adam in the Garden of Eden story, and how important these concepts are in our tradition, how we've dealt with them. There are two things that you have to get on the table before I can answer that question explicitly. The first is this. By and large, in the Jewish tradition, we do not take votes in matters of belief. This has a practical and a thematic basis. The practical basis is that it's a community that's about conformity of practice, and you kind of do have to take votes when it comes to maintaining some level of conformity of practice. There's a lot of regional variation, a lot of cultural variation, and a lot of interpretation even within levels of practice. Let's say about, you can't eat milk and meat together, but how long do you have to wait in between the two? There are wide variations in the answer to that question. But at the same time, in the Talmudic debates, you have to have some idea of, what blessing do you say over a banana? Is the blessing the one over plants? Because it seems to be a large plant, not really, it has qualities of a plant, not a tree. Or do you say the blessing over the fruit of a tree, produce of a tree, because it also has qualities of a tree? And you can't have that some of the rabbis walk around, teach their children to say one blessing and some say the other. You can't decide, well, is there a required prayer over the memorial candle? The answer is there isn't. But you can't have some people saying you have to do the prayer of the memorial candle before you light one, the Yahrzeit candle or the Shiva candle, and someone else says, no, you don't. Or do you wash your hands before, do you have to do a blessing and wash your hands before you eat a snack? Or is it just over a major meal? Do you have to do this particular prayer in the service? All of these, the rabbis basically take votes on. Are certain appliances fit for kosher use and which aren't? Are certain animals fit for kosher consumption and which aren't? So in general, they take votes so that there is a conformity of practice. Because they kind of practically have to. But it also has a thematic basis, which is that at the heart of Judaism is free thinking. That we don't believe largely that the judgment of God or the universe upon any human being really relates to their beliefs. The matter of idolatry is a separate lecture. But really, I think the rabbis would say the problem with idolatry is it leads to practices that are incompatible with proper human behavior. And so this ends up in the idea, basically, that everyone in Judaism goes to the afterlife who behaved properly, who behaved like a good human being, and that we're not examined. If whatever that examination would mean, an examination of by the cosmos, an examination by a deity, whatever judgment of a soul means, and we have to make that as non-literal as possible, we are all judged basically on how we behaved in this world. So we want a certain kind of understanding and conformity of behavior, but our beliefs actually do not weigh in. We don't get extra points for believing in Judaism over believing in something else. You don't get extra points for believing that miracles are true. Anything relating to belief is irrelevant for our basic goal in this universe, which is to behave in such a way on this earth that we are judged by God, whatever God means, but we are judged by God by our behavior. So number one is there may well be variation in how the concept of original sin is understood by the rabbis or even the meaning of the early Genesis stories. Because we're free thinking. We're allowed to kind of believe whatever we want about those stories, and we don't take votes on what is doctrine, what is official doctrine or not. The second thing that's important to understand here is the concept of sin has a wide range of meanings and is largely misunderstood. There's a lot lost in translation here. So when the Christians use the word sin, they are referring to a Jewish concept, a biblical concept, that in Hebrew is Yetzer Hara. Now, in English translations of the Torah, the Yetzer Hara is usually translated the evil inclination. in whether it's evil or whether it's selfish, it may be more in reality like a selfish inclination. Our desire to get everything we can for ourselves, our desire to have enough, our desire that I want that mate, and I want to be rich, and I want that food, and all of these, the selfish instinct is, the ego-centered instinct is called the evil inclination. In the Christian New Testament, Paul takes that concept of the evil inclination, and every description of his of sin fits precisely that model. So in other words, he's not taking over the Hebrew word for sin and using it to describe sin. He's taking over the concept of Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, and calling it sin. So the question you would say is, okay, I'm reading my English Bible and I get to this word sin, original sin, in the Christian Bible, but I also see that word in the Hebrew Bible and you're telling me that it's different? And the answer is yes. By and large, there are three Hebrew words for that get translated as sin in English translations. A chet, an avon, and a pesha. And they actually relate to different kinds of atonements you would do for each one. The vast majority of the sins that we do are classified as chet, which means error. They're unconscious errors. They're unintentional errors. Then why are we making them? Well, you could do an error because you don't have all the information you need. You could easily, there could be someone waiting for a phone call from you to ask how they're feeling or ask how they're doing at college or to ask whether they went to the doctor or you once had a conversation and didn't follow up. And you, it's not in your consciousness. You either don't know that they're pining for a call from you, or you forgot. So you're not intentionally not calling them, but that's an error. There's someone who needs you, who wants you, with whom you're in relationship, and you let them down. When you let someone down, it's an error, it's a mistake. In the English translations, that would be called a sin in the English translations in the Hebrew Bible. And it's not the same thing as what Paul says in the Christian Bible. Importantly about unintentional sins, it's vital for the Jewish concept of sin to understand how important that is. When we say we have a deathbed confession in Judaism, I do it frequently for people and with people, and the tenor of it is this. There is no way to be a perfect person in this world. We are limited human beings, limited in memory, limited in knowledge, limited in time. We are finite, and we live in a finite world in which it is impossible to be perfect, impossible to meet everybody's needs, impossible to do all the mitzvahs, impossible to know everything we need to know, impossible even to the point where I may often have a choice between, am I in this moment going to visit a grandchild? Am I in this moment going to visit a parent or visit a stranger who is sick? Or am I going to go to Minyan and help make a Minyan? And you actually kind of even know that you're just limited and you're only one person. You can't actually do every mitzvah. So you're actually, in a way, letting someone down even when you are helping someone else. So we can't be perfect. We can't do it all. And so in that sense, we are constantly making chets. We're constantly making unintentional errors. The word chet comes from archery. It means to miss the mark. There's no way to hit the bullseye all the time. We're always going to miss. We have to make compromises, like I said, about our time, because we may hit a bullseye with one and completely miss the target at the same time because there are two targets before us, or we may shoot in between. So the idea is that we mean well. We actually, far from the concept in a way of original sin, we actually really try to be good in this world, but we can't be perfect because it's an imperfect world. There are two other sins, I'll cover them very quickly, avon and pesha. And avon is a transgression, sometimes translated as sin, sometimes translated as transgression. It's intentional, but it's not like I murdered my brother. It's not like this, it's not, rape and murder. It's not this fallen devil-like state, it is that you really wanted to, I don't know, you really wanted that ice cream, even though you promised your wife you're on a diet, and so you ate the ice cream. Or, I don't know, my wife buys a chocolate bar, and I know it's for her, and I eat it anyway. And I tell her, oh, was that really for you? I wanted it, and I did it. I knew it was wrong. And some of those can be very serious, and a lot of them aren't at all. But it's an intentional sin. And the third kind is a pesha, which is a rebellious sin. It's a personal sin. It's where you knowingly did wrong, not for the benefit of it, but to thumb your nose at someone personally. So that your boss tells you they need you till 6 o'clock that day, and the truth is you could stay, but you're so sick of your boss making you stay late that you clock out at 5. And it's just a way of saying, hey, I'm just making life difficult for you. It's certainly a case of a rebellious teenager that they're angry at their parents, and so they break curfew, not because they actually were doing anything interesting that they wanted to stay out late for, but simply because they wanted to show their parents that they don't live under their authority, or they're angry about something. So it's a personal, intentional sin. But the basic idea is that those second two kinds are relatively rare, and most of our sins are these errors or mistakes. So those are the words translated as sin in the Hebrew Bible in English. But when you get to the New Testament, the Christian New Testament, and you get the word sin, and it's a translation of the Greek words, it's really a reference not to the Old Testament concept of sin. It's a reference to the Old Testament concept of Yetzer Hara, which appears multiple times in the Torah, to cover these appetites, these selfish appetites that drive your behavior. And so that's really the question we have to ask, which is that's the Christian concept of original sin, that we are driven by appetite that prevents us from living a life of mitzvah or holiness or God intention or goodness, because it dominates our nature and would have to thus be removed. So now when we look at the story, and we ask ourselves, do Jews believe in original sin? Don't think of the Old Testament concept of sin. Think of, do we believe that the Yetzer Hara, the evil or selfish inclination, is so overpowering, and is that we need some kind, and this is somehow reflected in the Old Testament story, the Hebrew Bible's story of Genesis, which is about how we are driven even when we were graced by God in the Garden of Eden, and therefore we need saving from that original sin state. That's what we're addressing.
How we understand those chapters is open to interpretation, and some of them did believe that this was a terrible sin that Adam and Eve did, and we were thrust out of paradise. So they believe that. There was a fall. I would say that the majority view was that God would never have let this happen if it wasn't secretly God's intention. In other words, that why would God have put all of this at their disposal if not that God kind of knew this was going to happen eventually? And they compare it to growing up. What they said is that Adam and Eve were in a childlike state, which kind of makes sense because it was like they were like the animals. Remember, they didn't wear clothes and everything was wonderful. They said, it's like an animal. It's like they don't have shame. They don't have self-consciousness. They act instinctually, a little bit like children. So at some point, those children were going, they weren't really capable of mature reflection and free will. They're like, if I take my dog, and I say, and they need to go to the bathroom. And I say, whatever you do, don't go on the tree of knowledge. They're going to be like, okay. But then if they really have to go, they're going to go on the tree of knowledge because they're a dog and they need to go, and that's a tree. So that the rabbis have kind of a primitive idea of evolution at that point, where the humanity, the Adam, was not a person. It wasn't like Adam was his name. Adam just means the human being or the human species. So it wasn't like we're talking about a guy named Adam, but rather whatever this species, this thing was, they lived like an animal in an instinctual state. So it was inevitable that they were eventually going to mess up and that they grew up.
After all, if they didn't have the knowledge of good and evil until after eating of the produce, then how is that sin to eat of it? Because they didn't know that it was the wrong thing. You could say, well, God told them, don't eat that. But they still don't necessarily have the knowledge of good and evil to know what's right and what's wrong. So it seems like it's problematic, to say the least, if not unfair, to accuse them of certainly intentionally sinning, or even falling from a state of what? Of grace? You could say it's falling from a state of innocence into a state of knowledge, but it's not exactly clear why that would be falling, rather than growing, unless you think somehow we can return to that state of innocence. And I actually don't think that's a Jewish value. I think if you wanted to think of one of the myriad ways of designing a mission statement for Judaism, it wouldn't be to return to the innocence of the Garden of Eden. It would be on some level a kind of adult innocence, which is not the same as a childlike innocence. It's a way of evolving a consciousness after the wisdom of experience and the knowledge of good and evil, to develop a way of living in the world that follows a plan that doesn't involve ego. That's a totally different thing than a childlike innocence. If you like, you could refer to my essay on adult gratitude and our prayer, the Kaddish, which is a statement of how do you say the Kaddish? How do you say our prayers, saying that I'm going to strive for an experience of transcendence and holiness and bring God's intentions for our world into reality collectively in our lifetimes, but also in each of my days? And how do I connect with a sense of honor and a sense of beauty and a sense of transcendence and a sense of joy, even though it goes beyond the words of consolation or poetry or even music and gratitude? How do you reach an adult gratitude after loss or after suffering or after despair from seeing things fall apart in our world? And that is the innocence, in a sense, if you want to call it that. It's an adult version of gratitude, not a return to a childlike state of dependency and desire and naturalness. So, of course, how can you say you're really breaking a rule and defying God if you're acting in that instinctual state? Sure, the serpent said, don't eat of the tree of knowledge. Or God said that, pardon me, of course. But the serpent's voice, if anything, is in a sense the development of consciousness, development of voices in our heads that start to lead us in certain directions, and reflection helps us refine how we choose to act in this world.
It was a story of maturity, of maturing to adolescence, to maturing to the ability, or what we would call evolution. They gained self-consciousness and free will, because the rabbis say, after all, what happened afterward? Oh, we're naked. Well, that's like a weird thing to say, but you know, that is the difference between us and animals. We have the self-consciousness that I'm aware of myself. So they viewed it as what today you might call a history of cognitive evolution. That at one point humanity acted instinctually, whether we were ancient primates of some sort, I don't think the rabbis had that idea, but they did have an idea that we had that kind of consciousness. We had a natural instinctual consciousness, and at some point, something big happened to our brains, and we got what you might call self-consciousness, sentience, that thing that makes us different as human beings, and that's what the fall really is. So it's not really a fall, it's growing up. It's an evolution. And then they say, well, when you think about it, so some of the things are, one of the punishments is that Eve is going to have pain in childbirth. Now, the rabbis of the Talmud didn't necessarily say this, but one of the theories out there is that our brains actually got bigger at that time in human evolution, and that the pain in childbirth for primates is not so bad because the head's not so big. But when Homo sapiens and Homo erectus evolved in Homo erectus, our brains literally got bigger. You can compare a Neanderthal brain to a Cro-Magnon brain, and you'll see that our frontal lobes grew quite a bit, which meant our skull was bigger, which meant women had more pain in childbirth. So what I like to argue is there's kind of a natural, when the rabbis say we as a species kind of grew up, it's not a fall. Our brains actually did get bigger when we developed all of this consciousness and whatever that evolutionary change was that makes us human and doesn't make us instinctual. And so most of the rabbis viewed it as kind of like God's a parent and we were children and God liked it like that. I mean, it's really nice to have children in a lot of ways. And I have two little ones. They're very pure. They're very beautiful. It's very magical. At some point, they got to grow up. And God knew at some point, why else is that apple there? Why else is that apple there? That apple's there because God knows at some point they're going to grow up. We got to let it happen. And so that in that sense, there's no sense of original sin. There's a sense of how can you hold someone accountable for original sin if they're acting kind of instinctually? They're not yet capable of such free will. And so the rabbis have this idea that that drama was going to play out that way. And so it wasn't so much a fall and original sin, and rather, so I'll tell you this in terms of Paul and Christian and the early Catholic Church, that so it does reflect in the basic idea of what the human being is in Judaism, which is that we are a combination, and this is straight from the Talmud, Midrash Rabbah. The human being is a combination of selfless instincts and selfish instincts. And it's both. So if you say, if someone is in an unredeemed state, aren't they in a state of sin? Meaning they can't get over their selfish instincts. And the Apostle Paul in Romans, particularly in chapter 7, talks a lot about that. What does it mean to be able to do good in this world? You know, do you need some kind of rebirth experience? Do you need some kind of connection to God through faith? Do you need some kind of salvation to be able to do good? Which he basically says yes. But in Judaism, the idea is you're good and you're bad. Sometimes you do selfish stuff, and sometimes you do selfless stuff. To be fair to Paul, I think Paul would challenge us all and say, my favorite line in chapter 7 is when Paul says, I'm taking the Paul's view for a second, that the rabbi is going to get off this one too easy. And the Talmud gets off too easy. Remember that Paul's actually writing in the time of the early Talmud, and they're completely aware. This is a major debate between the early Christians and the Pharisees and the Jews. So Paul's going to say to me, I'm like, hey, Paul, I'm altruistic too. I do good deeds too. And yeah, well, you know, I like a good steak and a beer and a schnapps, and you know, and sometimes I stay home and I like my, you know, like I'm selfish, but I'm also selfless. I do good things too. And Paul says, because that's kind of the Jewish view, and Paul says, wait a second. I don't know about you, but perhaps my greatest existential problem in my life, my spiritual life, is that I find I do the things I don't want to do, and I don't do the things that I really want to do. And I love that line. For a while, that was my screensaver because it's a great challenge to my tradition because there's a lot of truth in it. In other words, the rabbi said, we do good deeds. How many good deeds did you do today besides coming and listening to me, which was a fantastic good deed? But besides that, I mean, the truth is, what's for lunch, right? Got to fill that belly. And it better not be that the one dish that the casa chefs make poorly. I hate that. Why do we have to have, you know, meatless Monday? I can't stand it. So I want, what's for lunch? You know, why didn't my friend call me today or my children call me today? I want my call. You know, it's too cold in here. I want them to turn off the heat. Like we are, come on. How many good deeds do we do in a day? And it is a hard thing. How do we become someone who whose actions become more in line with what we really want to do? But, you know, we get pretty distracted. So Paul's attitude is we're hopelessly distracted. But the Jewish understanding is that we both have selfless instinct and selfish instincts. And the best, what you want to do in life is that sin is not your selfish instincts. Where Paul says, he said, you know, give me an example of some sins. And he says, gluttony, trying to fill your belly. All you care about is what's for lunch. Sex, all you care about is sex. I mean, all you care about is chasing girls and guys and whatever. So those are the two big ones. drinking, right? If you got the food and you got the sex, then what's to drink? Let's have a beer. Let's open up the schnapps. So, like, you know, and his attitude is it's that diversion. We're constantly drawn to it. But in Judaism, they say this. Oh, and also the desire to be better than everybody else. It's also a big driver of sin, which is, I'm gonna know more than the rabbi, and I'm gonna know more than them. In every conversation, I know better. I read my bullet points from my favorite website, and I'm gonna tell you you're completely wrong. Don't vote for Hillary Clinton. She doesn't know anything. Or don't vote, you know, we all have to be smarter than everybody else. So it's this competitiveness. And the rabbis say, take each of those examples. They're not original sin. They're not sinful. But those selfish instincts, they're all selfish, can be channeled into holy behavior and gives holy behavior its passion. So, for example, the rabbis aren't, whereas Paul doesn't always say the warmest things about sexual contact, right? Paul is a little bit like sexual contact. It's a vehicle for sin. Because it wakes up, it arouses your sexual libido, and that can lead you into sin. The rabbis say you should have passionate sexual relationship to the extent possible with your partner. They say you just shouldn't be running around with everybody, but you do that in your marriage, if you can. So the idea is the rabbis, they probably talk too much about sex. Most people don't want me to talk about what they talk about sex. I once asked someone, oh, there's a really good rabbi in La Jolla. Have you ever studied with him? And they said, I did, but he always talked about sex. And I stopped. And I'm like, well, the rabbis talk a lot about sex because they're like, sex is great, but you do it with the person you love only in the context of that trust covenantal relationship. But then have a ball. I quoted a story the other day. Do you want to hear a blue story from the Talmud? Or I'll let it go. Okay.
But it's in the Talmud.
You can. I'll take a vote. Who wants to hear a blue story from the Talmud? Okay. So I mean, the Talmud. Talmud says things like this. He said, "Once upon a," and it's talking about these things, which is, you know, once upon a time there wasn't a good relationship between this rabbi. Never slept with his wife. So then you'll tell me, Pastor, you'll never have me back after this one. Never slept with his wife. Said one day the wife dressed up as a streetwalker. The rabbi approached her, took her into his bed, and they had a passionate night. That's the end of the story. It doesn't give us a moral of the story. So some people read that story, and why is there a story of such a jerk rabbi, right, who really just, you know, and who wants to, you know, doesn't sleep with his wife. But I think the proper interpretation of that story, since there are a lot of these kinds of stories, is that, you know what goes on between a man and a woman in marriage, whatever makes them passionate with each other, that's up to them. We're not, rabbis don't crawl into your bedroom and tell you, oh, you got to do this or you got to do that. In other words, this worked for them. This re-energized their relationship, and it's nothing to be ashamed of, in other words, because he was a great rabbi. He wasn't a jerk. That's why it seems interesting. So in the context of a relationship, that sexual connection, it can be a wonderful thing. Each one of them is true. So let's just take drinking and eating. We'll make it really short. One of the things that bothers me in modern Judaism is if you live in a very religious Orthodox kind of community, you'll find that where you have to separate meat and milk, before every meal you got to ask, are we having meat meal or a milk meal? So I got to know whether I can, bring my hot chocolate in or my coffee, my latte. So if it's meat, I can't bring my latte. That's meat mixing meat. You always got to know. And in these communities, my God, they're eating a lot of meat. They're like, you know what? We're going to have spaghetti and meatballs for lunch. You know what? For dinner, we're having chicken. Not chicken parmesan, but we're going to have chicken. Tomorrow, we're going to have pastrami. And then for dinner, maybe we'll have hot dogs. And there's a lot of meat because since you have to keep milk and meat separate, you have to make a choice. And there's a lot of, why not? Let's have some meat for lunch. It'll be nicer. But actually, originally, we didn't eat that much meat. And the idea was, it is kind of gluttonous, in my opinion. This is my understanding of our tradition. Maybe it's a little bit not the mainstream idea. But I think it's clearly there, is that drinking and eating, and I could extend this from meat to sweets, right? It's for the Sabbath and holidays and simchas, joyous celebrations, birthdays, baby namings, your grandkids are visiting. Those are all simchas. So, you know, great-grandkids. The grandkids come in, they love brownies, we're having brownies. That's a simcha. It's a joyous occasion. It's a special thing. For the Sabbath every week, I grew up this way with my family. My father is a conservative rabbi. I grew up observant. was that during the week, I'd be sitting in the shopping cart complaining, right? Oh, Mom, when are you going to be done shopping? And my mom would say, but you know, you get to pick one thing for Friday night and Saturday, one sweet. Sometimes I picked a chocolate bar, like a Kit Kat. Well, she picked Kit Kats. That were her favorite. She always picked Kit Kats. And I was like, not the Kit Kats again. She's like, I like the Kit Kats. I could pick a Petridge Farm cake or a Sara Lee cheesecake. I loved the chocolate Bavarian pie by, I think it was Sara Lee or Petridge Farm. I could get Entenmann's chocolate-covered donuts. I got to pick one thing, and it would sit there on the counter until Friday night. As soon as we lit the Shabbat candles and we had dinner, you can eat it. If I wanted to eat all of it, I could eat all of it, but then there's nothing for the rest of the week. I could save some for Saturday. And it was pretty much all, if I didn't eat it, someone in the house finished it all on Saturday afternoon. So what I'm saying is that what the rabbi said in terms of original sin is that, yeah, you got your tummy, you've got other things you want to satisfy, we have selfishness, but you channel them into what, holy areas and holy times. Sabbaths, birthdays, holidays, and then you make the big pot roast, or maybe it's not pot roast, a brisket, right? But if you're eating brisket every day, that's a little strange. I've talked, or wine. a friend of mine who's a convert, she came to a Torah study of mine recently, and I put out a whole bunch of white wine and red wine. I put out a bottle of white and a bottle of red, had a whole group of adults in my house studying Talmud with me, and at the end, only this much of the white wine was gone and only this much of the red. And she said to me, if my relatives were here, they would have been asking for another bottle before they took their coat off, right? She's like, and she said to me, as a convert, she was saying, you know, there really is something to this Jewish thing where you give the kids wine on Friday night when you were here, they're at synagogue. I mean, they can have juice if they want, but I don't have a problem with the kids having that much Manischewitz on a Friday night. A little wine's okay, and you're showing them on special occasions we get the wine out. But absolutely in Judaism, in traditional Judaism going back thousands of years, if you're getting out the wine like King David at every meal, people are like, what are you getting out? You know, I'd be like, Brother Deming, what are you getting out? It's not the Sabbath. Is it a birthday that we don't know of? And if Pastor Deming is like, Rabbi Deming is like, no, I just thought we'd have more wine. People would be like, put it away. We'll bring it out when the special occasion comes. So it was moderation. It was moderation is fine. And it's a nice thing to get drunk on Friday night. It's a nice thing to get drunk at a wedding. Not if you get bad drunk, but I mean, it's nothing wrong with it. So those kinds of things. And finally, the competition one I mentioned earlier, education. They said competition is a good thing in education. There's nothing wrong with taking a fourth grader, or a second grader, or a 12th grader, or college student and say, I want to see who's going to write the best paper. I remember one of my favorite teachers ever was a math teacher in seventh grade, and what he did, and maybe people think this would be controversial today, I have no idea. So this is, 37 years ago, he would hand out the exams in the order of the best scores. And so when he went after an exam and he picked up those papers and he walked over, you knew that if the first paper he handed was to Jules, that Jules got the highest grade. And he would go in order. Now today, it'd probably been unheard of because everyone would complain to the principal that whoever got the last one, let's say I was the gut one, I got the last one, you humiliated my son in front of the whole class. So these days, that's not allowed. But the rabbis say, it's not a bad thing because a lot of those kids are like, I want to be higher in the pecking order and I want to get the best grade and I want to write the best poem and I want to write the best book report on Harry Potter. And the rabbi said, that's a good thing. And so they said, you get a reward for asking the best question. It's okay to be like, can someone ask a better question than these? I'm allowed to get your, I'm going to do better because it's for a purpose of education. So the original sin thing is a really big thing. So the basic idea of the rabbis is it wasn't a fall. It was growing up with free will. Are we possessed of original sin that we need something to wash us clean? Not really. What we are is a collection of self-interested impulses and also nice impulses. And what commandments, religion, observance, the Sabbath, holidays, what they do, education, they guide those selfish instincts into an area where they provide your passion for doing great things. Right? So if your passion is to build a children's wing of a hospital, some people, like when I was young, I thought that was obnoxious. I was like, oh, that rich person just wants their name on the, they want me to see that this isn't just children's hospital, it's Rady's Children's Hospital. I thought as a kid, they're so arrogant. When I grew up, I realized that the Talmud was right. which is, if you want to earn a lot of money, and what you want to do with that money is help children and put your name on a building and do it. That's like, that's what life should be. You know, that someone should feel like, now that I made my money through a lot of competition and maybe a little bit of kind of sinful, like selfish instincts. I mean, yeah, I did buy my boat and I got my house, but I want to take the rest of it and do great things. That's a good thing. That's how we do good deeds in the world. There's nothing to be ashamed of in that.
Some of the precepts that Paul postulates seem to be at odds with a number of Jewish understandings. Is there a kernel of teaching in the Mishnah or the Torah, in the Talmud or the Mishnah that would support Paul's positions as well in terms of his...
Paul presents himself, the architect of the Catholic Church, the architect of the early Christians, is Paul. At least he's the one that created the church that still exists. There were others at the time. But he presents himself as an Orthodox Jew. To what extent is that accurate? What extent does he have Jewish? Is he drawing on Judaism? On the one hand, we definitely don't see him as a Pharisee, as an Orthodox Jew. But I will say this, that this kind of debate I told you about, and I went on a long time ago about sin and stuff, it is a debate that happens during Paul's lifetime. And I think that partly because Paul took such an extreme position, it probably moved the Jewish leaders to take a very moderate position. So that the debate is partly a product of Paul's thinking. And it's not just that Paul... So how about before Paul lived, that what we call the intertestamental era, the late Second Temple period, are some of those Paul ideas really Jewish? And I would say that the answer is yes and no. We find, how is it yes? Some of the earliest rabbis who lived before Paul and before Jesus, I think that they tended to be more... think that you'll find more statements about the fall of man and the sin of Adam, even among Jewish thinkers. They were Jewish thinkers who were influenced by Platonism. And our view of Paul on one foot is that he may have been a Jew, but he was a little bit of a strange Jew. And because he was a Jew who was extremely partial to Platonism, Greek philosophy, and probably or maybe, I leave it to better scholars, maybe even to Gnosticism. Maybe not only to Platonism, I'll tell you what that is, and Greek philosophy, which is for sure, it's all over what he wrote. And so not Jewish philosophy, but Greek philosophy, but probably also to a new movement that existed in his lifetime that was taking Greek philosophy and making it very superstitious. And basically, Platonism says that there's perfection and there's imperfection. You know, there's the perfect good, there's the perfect triangle, right? So Plato said, think of it as in some perfect reality, let's say it's math, there is the ideal triangle. Do you ever find a perfect triangle in this world? It's always going to be a little off. Right? I could tell Jules, please make me a perfect triangle. And Jules could work all day in his shop. He's like, I think I got it right. If I use a careful enough laser ruler, I'm going to find it's 0.0001 degrees off. And the basis of Platonic and Greek philosophy was that there are these ideals and utopias and perfect ideas, but the world, it's all imperfect. Right? There's the perfect utopia, but every state has corruption and its problems. We'll never turn America into a utopia because utopias don't really exist in the real world. They exist in the philosopher's mind. And when that gets applied to religion, what do you get? You get the idea that there may be a perfect spirit in you and a perfect saintly will like Mother Teresa, but you never find that real sainthood. You never really find that real goodness, because the whole world is imperfect. So what goes from being in Plato, the imperfect triangle, the imperfect government, becomes the imperfect human being, which is original sin. Like, you think, oh, I can really love my wife. What Plato would have been like, yeah, pure love is a beautiful thing. Write a poem. But then Paul would have said, oh, you think you can have perfect love for your wife? I bet when you see a pretty actress in a movie, you're like, she's pretty good looking. I thought you said you loved your wife. But you're looking at the actress in the movie. So Paul took this idea that had to do with triangles and perfection, and he said, you see, this whole world, like Jules's triangle, it's all imperfect. It's fallen. And the only way to get to the ideal is through this new path. So what I would say is that we view him as more beholden to that idea. And some of the rabbis before he lived, probably his teachers, some of them were Jewish and some of them were Greek. Some of them were probably like, yeah, I can kind of make that fit with Judaism. Like, you know, this is an imperfect world and we got to make it better. And so some of those ideas were definitely around the Jews as well. But once Paul said them and started up a church, then the Jewish rabbis were like, yeah, we don't like that stuff anymore. We're definitely like, just, we're like, let's not read Genesis that way anymore. No, we'll leave that to the Christians.
Out the error of our ways.
Right, exactly. Right. And so, but I think there is an authenticity to those ideas were common among many Jewish rabbis because they read Platonism and they weren't so into the pollution of the body, but they understood God is perfect and the world's not. But when Paul took it that far, I think they really backed off and they were like, we don't want to talk about the fall of man. It sounds too Catholic. It sounds too like, because they said we're made in, all of us are B'Tselem Elohim. All of us are in the image of God. And if you go too far down that road that we're all polluted with imperfection and sin, what does that say about God if we're made in God's image and we're all imperfect? So they really went for this idea that don't say that, oh, perfection is only in the glint of the mind of the saint. No. We're all in God's image. We all have the ability to be good, and they really backed off on some of those ideas. And it's certainly a complicated and fascinating time. You have done me a great gift by allowing me to talk about ideas I'm passionate about, and I hope you have me back sometime in the future. So thanks very much. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
I'll keep it. These are good questions.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks at all. Thanks always.
And Paul, having grown up in Tarsus,
yep,
had to come from an area in which Judaism would have inevitably been forced to confront Greek
Hellenism,
even more.
Yeah.
Hellenism.
No, you're exactly right.
Yeah.
And I know that like one of my favorite professors is a guy named James Kugel, who writes about the intertestamental period, and you're quite accurate that some of those Greek ideas were definitely coming into many of the rabbis. But then, right, when Paul, especially when Gnosticism came, and then they saw the Dead Sea Scroll community in Qumran, they were then like, they didn't want anyone to travel down that road of being suspicious that the world is a fallen world. They saw the dangers of it. And they've specifically distinguished themselves, you know. But that's an evolutionary development itself. My dad used to always teach, as you brought, that, you know, that Christianity and Judaism are a little bit like a capital, sort of a capital Y. Like, once Christianity existed, Judaism changed a bit too, because there's that
sort of
dialectic.